You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. True Stories About the Great Fire. Opening photo. On June 5th, 11 days after George Floyd was killed, and the day Breonna Taylor would have turned 27, local organizers in Louisville, Kentucky, end the final march of the evening with a spirited display of power and community against injustice. In late May, as video of George Floyd's murder spread across the nation, Americans defied the pandemic and rallied to the streets in what would become the largest protest movement in decades. The story of those early days is told here by those who rose up, those who bore witness, those who grieved, and those who hoped. George Floyd, 46, is killed while being arrested by four Minneapolis police officers on Monday, May 25th. Bystander footage of the incident later shows Officer Derek Chauvin pin his knee to Floyd's neck for more than 8 excruciating minutes. Andrea Jenkins, member, Minneapolis City Council. I'm sitting up watching Netflix, and the message was, "Have you talked to the mayor yet?" That's all it said. I looked at it, but I didn't answer. Then I take the call from the mayor, and he goes, "There's been a police-involved death, but there were no guns involved," as if to say the police didn't shoot anybody. He explained that he thought it had to do with some kind of forgery. Stephen Jackson, former NBA player, Houston area native, longtime close friend of Floyd's. "I was taking a nap on the couch with my 6-year-old daughter that Tuesday. When I woke up, I saw that my girlfriend had sent me a video. She and I talk about police brutality all the time. I looked at it briefly and thought, damn, they killed another brother. Then I saw I had about 50 messages. I opened one from my friend Bun B, and it said, 'You see what they did to your twin in Minnesota?' That's when I realized it was Floyd. I lost it, started screaming, throwing stuff around, scared the mess out of my daughter." Keith Ellison, Minnesota Attorney General. "I usually get up around 5:30 and look at my phone, and I started getting emails and texts containing the video from people I knew. I'm sitting there with my legs dangling over my bed and my boxers and my t-shirt, and I'm reading this stuff, and I'm like, oh my goodness, here we go again." Muriel Bowser, Mayor, Washington, D.C. "I was struck by not just the officer who choked Mr. Floyd, but the other officers watching. You have an officer that is applying deadly force and other officers watching. All of it is so hard to fathom that all of those people were watching this as he was begging for his life. And I was thinking how scary that must be for this child who was doing the recording." Sherilyn Ifill, President, NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. "You're listening to the residents who are saying what they're saying. Stop it. You're killing him. Are you going to just allow this to happen? Take his pulse," and so forth. So you're hearing all of that. There's another video where there's just engagement with one of the officers on the scene, and basically the crowd kind of exhorting him to find his humanity. So there are lots of ways to view this, and each one of them is actually very, very important to understand the sickness that we have allowed to pervade our system of law enforcement in this country. Jael Kurandi, former student body president, University of Minnesota. I saw the video, but I didn't want to watch it right away. You could see the captions. I knew what I was waiting to see. Ian Fields Stewart, activist, founder of the Okra Project. I have stopped consuming Black Death. It's too painful. It's enough to know. It's enough to know their names. Keith Ellison. I was struck by the brazenness of it, the length of time. It was something that stuck with me, the defiance of the people who are pleading for assistance, the indifference to the pleas of the victim. Because if you look at a lot of these cases that involves a shooting, it happens in an instant. You know, there are many questions to be asked about them, but there's always this idea, this is a decision that's made in an instant. It doesn't excuse it, but, you know, the idea that somebody could say, well, I was startled and reacted, is present in a shooting-style case. In this one, it was slow, agonizing. It was shocking. Raquel Willis, writer, activist, founder, Black Trans Circles. I did not watch the full video. Even today, I have not watched the full video. I watched portions of it. I felt disgusted. I felt disappointed. I felt rage. But a part of my feeling was a bit numb because I've been here before, and I think specifically as a Black trans woman, what people don't understand is we almost deal with it exponentially more because we're mourning Black cis men. We are mourning the Black women that are killed. We are mourning Black queer folk. And of course, we're mourning ourselves. Lex Scott, founder, Black Lives Matter, Utah. I've been in this business for 6 years. I can't tell you the amount of videos I've seen like that. That's not the first video. I hope it's the last. When other people watch that video, terror and horror goes through their mind. In my mind, I see what I've seen for 6 years, a Black man being murdered by a police officer who probably wouldn't be charged. I've seen too many. I don't want to say I'm desensitized by it, but honestly, the first thing that I thought is, oh my gosh, this family is not going to get justice. Just like Darian Hunt's family, just like Patrick Harmon's family, just like Elijah Smith's family. Lisa Clemens, retired Minneapolis police sergeant, volunteer, Twin Cities Mutual Aid, founder, A Mother's Love. I can't tell you what woke me up, but I woke up in the middle of the night. It was like midnight, 1 a.m, and I got on Facebook. And I saw this video and this warning of how graphic it was. I watched it, and I immediately picked up the phone, and I called a retired Black female lieutenant. I called the deputy chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, and I called the chief himself and said, "What am I watching?" He had not seen the video, and I said, "This is horrible. I just watched a man die in front of my eyes, and I am sick." He said, "Lisa, I'm going to convene an emergency meeting. This is the chief. At 10 a.m, please come." At 10 o'clock, we were all seated in his office. I asked him but one question. "Do you have the power to fire immediately, chief?" Because I knew he had created a policy that had allowed him that, because we asked him that cases be sent out immediately involving police, if there's bodily harm or death. He came back in an hour. He had fired all four. A long struggle. Al Sharpton, MSNBC host, founder, National Action Network. I got a call from Ben Crump, who told me he was talking to the family, and he's probably going to represent the family, and that they were interested in me becoming involved to give them a framework for fighting like I had done with Ben for Trayvon. I was emotionally, absolutely outraged. And my thoughts were, how do we have this sustained level of reaction and use this to really bring to light what we've been trying to do since Rodney King? What I was afraid of was an initial big move, and then it just peters out. So when Ben called me, I told him that we need to really make sure that we're going to sustain this. The other part I wanted to know is how strong the family was, whether the family had the kind of intestinal fortitude for a long struggle. He put me on the phone with Philinis, one of George's brothers, and the brother told me that they were going to fight till they get justice. I told him that I was willing to help in that fight. Sherilyn Ifill, it's such a powerful through line between George Floyd lying on that street saying, I can't breathe, and Eric Garner on a street in Staten Island in 2014 saying, I can't breathe. It is important for us to remember that what we see today is built on the platform of what we saw in Ferguson and what we saw in Baltimore. It's built on the platform of seeing Walter Scott running in that park in North Charleston. It's built on the platform of seeing Terrence Crutcher with his hands up, shot by Betty Shelby in Tulsa. And it's built on the platform of watching Ahmaud Arbery essentially hunted weeks before. I think some people think that the activism went away, but it didn't. Lex Scott, in 2014, I watched the video of Eric Garner being choked to death on film. I would post on Facebook every day, let's get in the streets, let's try to change this. I created a group called United Front Civil Rights Organization. I went and protested in Ferguson twice. Then people started saying, you should start a Black Lives Matter chapter in Utah. Since we started the chapter 3 years ago, we have held a summer camp for black children 2 years in a row. We purchased a Black History bus. It's a school bus that we're turning into a Black History museum. We hold Know Your Rights trainings. We register inmates to vote in 3 jails. We're a full-service civil rights organization. So we take civil rights complaints from prisoners, inmates, etc. We have also been working with the Salt Lake Police Department for 3 years in a row. We have gotten the police to implement 3 types of de-escalation trainings, implicit bias trainings. Last year, they removed 70 lethal weapons from their vehicles and replaced them with less than lethal weapons. Amaya Butler, Black Lives Matter activist, Crown Point, Indiana. When the whole Trayvon Martin thing sparked, I couldn't have been older than 13, 14, so I really didn't know how to use my voice. I was scared to speak out, but when this all happened, I was like, you know what? I'm coming of age where I need to start speaking out on injustices and putting my hand in it and saying my piece and being a part of the movement. I was like, I'm not going to sit down for this. Bruce Wilson, Black Lives Matter activist, Greenville, South Carolina. If you're going to march, you do it. You go looking for peace. You try to make sure you keep the peace. Keep your individuals that are with you, that are joining in. You try to keep them on track. And you just get started and let the emotion lead you. Stephen Jackson, I felt so helpless. The common sense side of me said, you can use your voice. So I just let my heart lead me to Minnesota the next day to set up a march and a press conference. A lot of the time in these situations where police murdered somebody, the first thing they do is look up their background and try to demean their character and try to make the murder that they committed seem worth it. I've seen that happen so many times when they murder somebody. The first thing they do is try to bring up their past. They was a drug dealer. They got arrested for this back in the day. They got pulled over for tickets. The littlest thing they can find to try to demean his character. What Minnesota didn't know was he had somebody who he considered his twin, who had one of the biggest podcasts in the country. At a press conference Thursday afternoon, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman calls Floyd's death senseless, but also says that his office's investigation will take time and that there is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge. Protests continue to grow in size and intensity in Minneapolis and start to spread beyond the city. Sherilyn Ifill, the idea that you're going to toy with the public that has been through this kind of trauma of watching this, just a few years after the trauma of watching Philando Castile bleed out in his car, you're going to taunt the community with the idea that there's something else that still has yet to be seen, was just outrageous. Al Sharpton, I was told that the DA had a press conference, had said that there may have been contrary evidence suggesting what we saw on the tape wasn't all there was to it. I started calling Keith Ellison, who I'd known since he was in Congress. I said to him, Keith, why aren't you, as Attorney General, able to take the case? And he said, I can't take the case unless it's given to me. I understand your trepidation with the DA, but I have no authority unless it's given to me. I said, well, maybe we need to help give it to you. And he said, I can't get into that, Rev. That's when I called the governor. The governor returned the call, and Keith was on the phone, and the governor said, I can assure you, Reverend, we're going to have a full investigation, and we'll work with the DA. And I said, well, I'm troubled by what the DA said. There's trouble in the feeling on the ground about the DA, and I recommend that you give the case to the Attorney General. He was noncommittal. He said, I register what you are saying. Others have said it. And he said, we'll get back with you, but I assure you we're never going to sweep this under the rug. Keith Ellison, I saw the press conference on the news. I know Erica McDonald, and I know Mike Freeman well, so I'm watching all of this unfold. Mike called me. He's a friend of mine. We've worked on things before. We've agreed and disagreed on things. But he called me and he said, look, what if we teamed up on this? Al Sharpton, in Minneapolis, when I was at the mall doing that MSNBC interview, people crowded around. And when I was walking away, somebody kind of tugged on my jacket sleeve. I looked down. It was a young white girl, and I'm like, maybe this kid's going to call me a name. I looked down, and she put a fist up and said, no justice, no peace. It amazes me because that slogan started in Howard Beach in the late 80s, and I kind of made it popular. I don't even know who started it. It almost brought tears to my eyes. I could never in a million years, when we were marching in 87 in Howard Beach, saying no justice, no peace, think that I would hear a white girl in Minnesota say that to me, which gave me hope. There's going to be protest. Jamie Schwesnittle, owner, Moon Palace Books, Minneapolis. Immediately, I thought, there's going to be protest at the third precinct, which is half a block from us. And so already I was figuring out, how can we be ready to make food for the protesters? I was just assuming that there would end up being some kind of encampment, and we were looking at potentially weeks or months of people camped out in front of the police precinct. That changed when I saw vanloads of cops with grenade launchers and riot gear pulling up on all the side streets, realizing, oh, it's not going to be an encampment. It's going to be a riot. The police are here to shoot stuff at people. Omar Jimenez, CNN correspondent. I remember getting a call from one of our editors in Atlanta saying, hey, we're getting some reports on social media of something happening at the police precinct nearby. Can you head over there? We get there, and that is when you started seeing some of the confrontation because we could hear it as we came around the corner. Flashbangs going off. Linda Tirado, freelance photojournalist. About 15 minutes before curfew, we saw protesters coming from the direction of the third precinct. They said that they had started gassing early and that they hadn't given any dispersal warning. These were protesters that had not meant to push curfew, so they weren't wearing PPE. I put on the respirator, my goggles, and headed off in that direction. I was lining up an establishing shot. I always take the police lights behind here because they make this amazing orange-purple refraction. Then I just felt my face explode. I just kind of squeezed my eyes shut and put my hands up and started yelling, "I'm press! I'm press!" Protesters came, took me by the hand, took me to the back of the protest section, I'm assuming, and took me to, I assume, a medic stand, because somebody then bandaged my eye. They tossed me in one of their personal vans, drove me to the ER. I was in surgery within an hour of the injury, and then I woke up the next day, half blind. Around 10 p.m. local time, Minneapolis police abandoned the 3rd Precinct Station House, which is later burned. Killer Mike, rapper and activist. In my mind, in my opinion, the most beautiful form of protest that happened out in Minneapolis was that police station burning, because it said directly from the public to the police, "We will accept this no longer." People were finally angry enough not to care about AutoZone, not Target, but to take it directly to government. We pay people to quote-unquote govern us, and that government has become evil, maniacal, and manipulative. It is our duty to burn down the government. Omar Jimenez. We first got to that scene there at, I want to say, like 2:30, 3 a.m. We were now a block away, and this huge structure was just on fire. You could see it, the glow of it, from blocks away as we were driving up in the early morning. When we got there, it literally seemed like something out of Mad Max or some apocalyptic movie, because everybody had on masks. People were out with baseball bats watching this entire huge structure on fire. The buildings on the right and left of it are completely blown out from flames of the previous night. There's no law enforcement anywhere to be seen. Little did we know, a little up the block, state police and the National Guard had shown up. So everybody showed up within a matter of 5 minutes after literal hours of anarchy. They just cleared out everybody, and now it was back to a sense of calm as the sun was beginning to come up. There were no warning signs. There was a protester or someone who ran. I'm looking at that like, oh my God, well, it's live TV, let's roll with it. And as this is happening, someone from State Patrol did come up behind me, and they had their arm on the back of my arm. I didn't think twice about it. Probably thought that they were making sure we stayed out of their way. The only indication I ever got that something was wrong was when they said those words, "You're under arrest." I even asked them, "What did you say?" And they said, "You're under arrest." Even in that moment, I think there was a sense of shock, trying to figure out, like, how? What could have possibly been done in that moment to warrant an arrest? All of that was going through my head. The photographer had time to sort of pan around and literally zoom in on me as I'm being led away into the distance. I'm asking the state patrol person who's leading me away, saying, "Hey, man, like, between you and me, what happened there?" And he just said, "I don't know, man. I'm sorry. I'm just following orders." And that's the most explanation I ever got. By Friday evening, major demonstrations are underway in cities nationwide, including Phoenix, Denver, Memphis, and Columbus, Ohio. In New York City, more than 200 protesters are arrested in increasingly violent clashes with police, who use pepper spray and batons as crowd control measures. In Atlanta, protesters mass at the CNN Center following a peaceful gathering at Centennial Olympic Park. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms organizes a press conference. Killer Mike. We were getting calls that the civil protest was getting more uncivil, and somehow maybe it wasn't just the Atlanta protest organizers who were starting to push back. and T.I. was asking me to come help, so it didn't lead to confrontation with the police. For an hour, I was saying absolutely not, because at some point, the political class in this country, be it black or white or whatever, are going to have to start holding the enforcers of the state, the police, accountable. As the hour ended, he's just like, "You're just going to let your boy go by himself? And you know, that's my friend, and we from Atlanta, and we from the same neighborhood. You don't let your boy go by himself." I was like, "I'll go stand in solidarity with my friend, because I know he's going to try to do what's in his heart to make sure that the people of Atlanta are safe." Now, me as his homeboy, I'm just in the moment, and I'm so furious because I can't contain my anger. I don't have the best attitude. I don't trust myself to talk. And then my friend gives me the podium, and you guys get to hear audibly what is going on in my head. I'm here not to speak on the behalf of a police department, which my father has been a part of, my cousins are a part of, that the original 8 black policemen who were treated as the N-word were a part of. I'm here because this is a black city, and it's a black enclave that holds real black power. And that's everything from business and commerce to religion and philosophy to black intellectualism at the AUC, and even down to the black political class, mayor, city council people, and even the class that are policemen, firemen, teachers. I didn't see, and I don't see, the purpose in destroying a fort for black power. I got it from both sides. It was a hell of a spot to be in. I did not enjoy being there, but I hope that I gave a measure of truth that allowed Atlanta to see a city where black people have the political, social, and economic power to help blacks in other cities righteously protest and bring about specific change. Michael Eric Dyson, academic. Killer Mike's speech was a remarkable testimony to the impossible balancing act that so many black people have to do. We understand the rage and the rebellion, and at the same time, we don't want to leave our own community in such tatters that after the cleanup is done, we are the ones who will suffer permanently, or at least far longer than others will. Around 1 a.m., the president takes to Twitter to call protesters thugs, and then advises, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Twitter censors the tweet, deciding the post violates its rules against glorifying violence. Muriel Bowser. The president tweeted out that he would release vicious dogs and ominous weapons on the district. That's when we really recognized that something was going to happen with Donald Trump. I was struck by the intentionality of the racial undertones. I thought those words were very purposefully chosen. They were words that were meant to hearken back to a time when African Americans were terrorized in this country. And to use that language in the nation's capital, a place that has the largest black population by percent than any other big city, that was what told me they had a plan. Keith Ellison. It reminds me of something I would see from Al-Sisi, or something I would have read about that Pinochet did. It reminds me of something that you would see in some country far away, where there is an authoritarian leader bullying and threatening with a military against the population. Sherilyn Ifill. The president is reaching back into history and declaring who he is in historical context. He's reaching back and cloaking himself in the language of George Wallace and a racist Miami sheriff to bond to this moment. And now the president is essentially seeming to endorse a violent reaction to people either looting or perceived to be looting or perceived to be engaged in violent contact. So that's a powerful, powerful moment that once again almost reinforces the protest itself, right? Irene Koo, Chair, Democratic Socialist of America, Washington, D.C. Chapter. It was just surreal to go from just being in my house all the time, working from home, only going outside to pick up groceries or go on a walk around the neighborhood, to being in the middle of a very, like, fervent, frustrated, angry crowd. It was kind of terrifying, but it was good. It was definitely anxiety-inducing around, like, COVID, and knowing that there was a risk there, and living in a group house and everything, too. But it felt really important. As soon as I went to the first one, I was like, yeah, we're going to try to show up every day this week. They were shouting their pain. New York, Washington, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia enact curfews. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear calls the National Guard into Louisville. Utah Governor Gary Herbert orders the National Guard into downtown Salt Lake City. In the days and weeks that follow, protests begin to spread outside major cities and onto main streets in places including Westport, Connecticut, Casper, Wyoming, and Fairbanks, Alaska. Organizers in the small town of Crown Point, Indiana, hold a Black Lives Matter rally with around 50 attendees. About 20 white counter-protesters, many with assault weapons, line the marchers' routes back to their cars. Amaya Butler. There were people across the street yelling slurs, Trump 2020, all types of mess. My best friend was actually following behind us in the car to make sure we had a ride back home, and one of the people tried to run her off the road as she was driving behind us. She showed up to the final spot with tears in her eyes, hysterical. I came to the realization that there's just so much hate and racism hiding in plain sight. I've never experienced anything like that living in Crown Point for most of my life. So I was just like, wow, these are people that I see. I pass every day. You know what I mean? I was just taken aback. But I can't focus on that. I'm not going to give all my energy to people that hate me. We made it so that everybody knew this is peaceful. Whatever you see, whatever you hear, your response needs to be Black Lives Matter. People were driving past, giving us the middle finger, cursing at us, all types of stuff. And I was just like, God is with us. God is going to protect us. Lex Scott, there's a group of people standing around outside in Salt Lake City and just yelling at police. And I pull up my megaphone and I go, it's time to go home. The protest is over. The police are in riot gear, and the whole crowd just erupts, screaming at me. I honestly probably shouldn't have gone there. But I was saying, when you hold violent protest, when you destroy property, they call me. It's my name on the headline. They're blaming Black Lives Matter. We have a police reform bill. We are trying to get this passed. You are detracting from the message. I said, I get it. We mourn broken bodies. You don't mourn broken buildings. You can rebuild a building. You can't bring back George Floyd. The riot is the language of the unheard. But what you're not going to do, you're not going to claim Black Lives Matter. I was yelling at them. They were yelling at me. It almost got really violent out there. And I said, you need to go home. I'm crying. And they said, you have no right to tell us to go home. We have the right. If we want to burn the city, we can burn the city. We have the right to do that. And I said, well, okay. I'm not going out there anymore. But what I'm going to do is hold a peaceful protest so you guys can see what it looks like. Over the next month, an estimated 14,000 demonstrators are arrested. The New York Times reports that on June 6th alone, more than 500,000 people participated in protests across the country. Seth Towns, Ohio State basketball team, detained at Columbus protest. Everyone who was out there was 100% peaceful. They were shouting facts about systemic oppression and police brutality, and they were shouting data. They were shouting how they felt about it. They were shouting their pain. That's the one thing that struck me the most. It was just a huge display of collective pain. I just had tears streaming down my face because it was just so powerful. We started marching down the street, and the police started following us, and again, it was 100% peaceful, but it was just this huge display. What had been like 50 people ended up turning into 500. And this huge display of protest, you know, not just the murder of George Floyd, but so much of the pain that comes from all forms of systemic oppression. As we were walking, the police were following us. They made a stance in the street, and the police start pushing us back. So now we're walking backward, and the police are following us. And it all just happened so fast. I just remember 1 second being out there screaming George Floyd, screaming Black Lives Matter. But seconds later, 6 police officers just came up, surrounded again, and put me in handcuffs. I was just walking backward with all the other protesters. Micaiah Foster, graduating high school senior, Simi Valley, California, where the Rodney King trial took place. I had 20 followers on Twitter. I really didn't think much of it at all. Once it started gaining attention, I was like, okay, so, Mom, I did a thing. I'm organizing a protest in Simi, but nobody knows it's me. When we start the march and I go out towards the sidewalk and I see all these people, I was honestly shocked. I did not expect that at all. I didn't even expect a few hundred. I was honestly just mind blown. At the end of the day, I don't know how to count that many people, but some people were saying they estimated about 2,000 to 3,000 people, and I was like, what? Is that a real number? That's crazy. It's still crazy. I still can't believe it. I finally was in a place in Simi where I wasn't the only black person in the vicinity. That was probably the most people of color or the most black people I've seen in one place in Simi in my entire life. Ian Fields Stewart. I was asked to speak at rallies and protests and all kinds of things, and I think, what is there to say? There's just that inexplicable grief that you always have to put on hold because something has to be done. And so you don't ever really get to live in it. It just lives in you. Sometimes it bursts out when you're not expecting it. Sometimes it manages to find a space or a place that feels in some kind of resolution. And I know that's true, to be honest with you, but it gets even more just like become numb. Yeah, what is there to say? Terrence Monahan, Chief of Department, New York City Police Department. It was a large gathering up at Times Square, close to 1,000 and change. The main group had made it down to Washington Square. There were obviously people as they walked by or were standing in front of us, cursing at us. But at that point, you were able to just really ignore them. There were speeches being given in the park. What happened was 2 demonstrators had gotten into a fight. So some of our cops were over there. They see the fight, and the loser of the fight walk away and grab a bag. He reached into the bag and starts walking back towards the park. So they have a feeling that he was going for a gun. An arrest was made. People started to circle around, and they start trying de-arresting tactics. By the time I got over there, we had a team of around 20 uniformed officers that had formed a line inside the park to allow the arresting officers to get out. The protesters are right in our faces, yelling and screaming and cursing at that point. Probably a couple of hundred demonstrators. My head is, how do we de-escalate this and get the protesters to start moving along to wherever they want to march? I wanted to get my cops out of the park without a confrontation. Let's not forget, this is the 3rd day of demonstrations. On the other days, we were bombarded quite heavily with bottles and rocks. So I didn't want this to start to escalate into a handful of cops being attacked by 5,000 protesters. The crowd kept advancing. And that's when one of the organizers turned to me. "Please, Chief, I need help. Please come stand with us. Stand with us." At that point, I'm looking at people who are actually protesting for a reason, that are looking for unity. So I had absolutely no problem going and standing with them and talking. At that point, he says, "Kneel with me," and I said, "I will, after I speak to the crowd." I wanted to let them know that no one supported what happened in Minnesota. No one, no police officer in this country would look at Minnesota and think that it was okay what they did. This shouldn't be a confrontation between the communities that we're working with on a regular basis and the cops that serve them. And that was the message at that point to calm the crowd. What I said was totally spontaneous. You know, you look at the situation and you have to react to it. You can't just stand on the sidelines. You have to be in the middle to try and de-escalate. Use what you know and speak from the heart. Yeah, some other cops had kneeled around the city before that. But no, I had never even considered it at that point. I said to the organizer, "With you, I'll take a knee." I joined hands with him, and I went down on the knee. They were asking for the other cops to kneel, and I told him, "No, I'm the leader. I'll take the knee." He understood that. I took a knee because I had a connection with those guys who realized this wasn't about going against the police. It was about a movement, and it was about unity. I had absolutely no problem going down with them. Never saw him before. I haven't seen him since. Don't even know his name or who he is. All I know is that he stepped up in a moment and was looking for peace. Seth Towns. So, obviously, there's the individual police officer, and then there's the entire system of American policing, which is really what we're out there protesting for. You can't look at it on an officer-by-officer basis, but the system that perpetuates these instances of police brutality, such as the ones with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others. That's why we're out there protesting. And it pissed me off the following day to see police officers walking with protesters, because that's not the agenda here. It's not for you to walk with us and then days later kill another innocent black person. We want justice. Over the weekend, as protests continue in Washington, President Trump and his family are briefly taken to a White House security bunker. On Monday evening, June 1st, the president delivers remarks in the Rose Garden, then walks across Lafayette Square for a photo op at St. John's Episcopal Church. Federal troops clear his path. Muriel Bowser. By Monday, I think that they were trying to figure out what they could unleash on the district, from talking about taking over our police department to bringing in the National Guard to having the Army around. That was part of their kind of shock and awe campaign. And it was a shocking statement to think that the federal government would try to impose its will on the local government and the local population on a local policing matter. Some of the conversations I won't discuss in detail, but the suggestion that the White House would take over the D.C. police, I said no immediately. My job in any of those conversations is to defend the District of Columbia, our autonomy, our borders, our First Amendment rights, and so we pushed back. There, to my understanding, was no violence and no reason to have to move the crowd. I reached my TV at home as the president was coming out to speak. They were showing a split screen of him speaking and the square being cleared, and then one of the reporters just kind of running away. It was all very confusing. What are we looking at? It was just all quite bizarre. I'm convening my team to figure out what's happening there. When he finished and said he was going somewhere special, I had no clue what he meant. As he walked to the church, I remember thinking that, you know, what were they all doing there? The people with him, they all looked a little dumbstruck. And it turns out that I think some of them didn't know where they were going. They were just following behind him. And then he made that very odd move of holding that Bible. On Wednesday, June 3rd, Ellison upgrades charges against Chauvin to include second-degree murder and charges the three other responding officers with aiding and abetting murder. Keith Ellison, the protests were going strong at that point, and I was aware that new charges could have an effect, but that's not why I did it. I told my staff, it's about what the law requires and what the facts have to show, full stop. That is what we decided. I was aware that it could, but I didn't allow myself to dwell on it. We charged the highest ethical charge we could. Sherilyn Ifill, every one of us has that circumstance in which you are new to your job and you have been trained, and sometimes that training is designed to have you do things differently than it's been done in the past. But when you get in the situation of work, the people who are experienced and who supervise you tell how it really goes down. So all of this talk about training, recruiting new officers and training new officers, then you put them in the car with the field training officer like Derek Chauvin, and it's literally like the movie Training Day. What is it that you expect to happen? Now, that does not absolve the junior officer, because each one of us has to come into the workplace as a morally whole person. That's the lesson of Nuremberg, right? You can't say, I got orders and they told me to do it. You are responsible for being a morally whole person in the workplace. Keith Ellison, after we adjusted the charges, we had a conference call with the Floyd family. I wanted to get them ready for character attacks on George. I mean, those of us who are in political life, you know, we wake up and read 5 stories about what a bad person you are, and so we're used to it. We choose it, so we don't need any sympathy. But if you're a person who, like George Floyd, has just lived the life of a private citizen, it can be very disconcerting to be the target of unwarranted hostility in the public sphere. And to see somebody you've admired and grown up with and loved tarnished so as to advance somebody's political position, it can be very disturbing. I'm still, like, thinking about what happened to poor Trayvon Martin for going to get a Snapple and some Skittles. He gets attacked by a vigilante and gets murdered. And for his trouble, we get to hear about, you know, hoodies and marijuana, all this BS that had nothing to do with why he was attacked. There is a model that is followed whenever you have a black victim of official violence. First of all, attack the victim. Tarnish the victim. Besmirch their reputation. Search out anything you can to make their life not very important. Make it so their death is not a big loss, because they were never a good person. That is the goal. So I thought it would be important just to help the Floyds be ready. On June 4th, George Floyd's family holds a private viewing service at North Central University in Minneapolis before public viewings and memorials in his birthplace, Fayetteville, North Carolina, and hometown Houston. Al Sharpton, we were getting ready to leave the hotel in Minneapolis to go to the memorial service. We got a call, and Ben Crump and I gathered everybody in a room at the hotel, and the family took a call from President Obama. That was the first time that I kind of felt they exhaled, because it was very comforting to them. That was the first time I saw solace in the family. They talked for about 20 minutes. And what the president kept talking about was, you need to stay together. We need to have peace, but we need to deal with things. He did not talk about Trump. He did not talk about the DA. He kept it on a very comforting level, and you could almost feel the ease of them, because this was Barack Obama talking. At the end of it all, President Obama said, Reverend, does anybody want to say anything? We were on a speakerphone. Phil and Eve said, well, we appreciate the call. The family, we're all here, and we really appreciate you taking the time. And the president said, well, is there anything y'all want me to do other than what I've said publicly? And Phil and Eve said, yes. One, we want justice, whatever you can do to fight for justice. And secondly, can you get some food down here? This is the first time everybody kind of laughed, because Phil and Eve kept complaining that all the restaurants were closed, and all we had was salad stuff and finger food. He said, I ain't on Reverend Al's diet. It kind of settled everybody before we put them in the limousine. In the early hours of Friday, June 5th, a Washington, D.C. Public Works crew paints a Black Lives Matter mural on 16th Street, directly across from Lafayette Square. Muriel Bowser, reclaiming that part of the street, became our focus to push the police force back and then use that opportunity to install some art. We have a program here called Murals DC, and this is part of the Murals DC program. It was more than the art. It was the message, using affirming words to mark how we could take this from being an occupied few blocks in DC to a place where people could be peaceful and protest. After we came up with the plan, it rained, so I was concerned that they wouldn't be able to start painting. If they could get it started, I knew they'd be able to get it done overnight. I first saw it the next day when I came to unveil the renamed street. You really have to get above it to see it fully, so I went up into an office building. It's very powerful. First of all, it's beautiful, but also it's having the White House in the background to punctuate it. It's perfect. Michael Eric Dyson, it was beautiful because at the very moment that the Confederate flags and Confederate statues are being pulled down, and even Columbus being pulled down, not only here but across the world, that you got to replace it with something. Symbols are necessary. Iconography is critical. You can pull some of it down, but what are you going to replace it with? And to literally paint the street of gold, right? Jesse Jackson, civil rights activist. I wish Dr. King and Mandela could be here a minute to see the fruits of their labors and those who have been killed along the way. In some sense, this was a radical reaction to Trump winning in 2016, but the wheels of justice grind slow but fine. America, as bad as things are right now, we've never been this good before. We've never had this many blacks and brown and Asian Americans in Congress. You look at Johnson's speech before the 65 Congress. It was all white men sitting there. And now I'm seeing tremendous changes that give me reason to be hopeful. Michael Eric Dyson, it is new. It's new. It's different. It's unlike what happened in 68 in the aftermath of King's death. It's unlike what happened in the 60s more broadly. You know what it's like? It's like the fusion of the SDS and the civil rights. This is the love child of two movements in the 60s, and they've come together, married with children. And it is heartening and gives me hope to see that multiracial arrangement. This is the real rainbow coalition, too, of Jesse Jackson, to come to fruition, right? He talked about it. But now we see it in a serious way, and it's white people taking a risk to say we're going to stand with and identify with black people, and we're going to take the same risk in certain ways that they are. Linda Tirado, I was back at work 5 hours after they discharged me. I woke up at about 9 a.m. on Saturday, and I was working by 1 p.m., trying to sort out witnesses and retweet all the leads and the tips that I got. They thought that my eye was going to stop me, and I'm like, you haven't met me, have you? Sherilyn Eiffel, I think it's unprecedented. I don't have any doubt that this is game-changing and potentially transformative. The minute I saw police union leaders basically throwing Derek Chauvin under the bus, they know something's changing too. So the fact that we are having a conversation about police union budgets and police union contracts, the whole narrative shift. because one of the ways that law enforcement has been able to hold back any scrutiny of its actions and a real encounter with what justice is supposed to look like has been because they have had a more powerful narrative. They have more shows on TV. They've created a whole mythology around who they are. They've had a very, very powerful narrative, and that narrative has unraveled. It may be the most powerful thing that has happened in the last month is the unraveling of that narrative, and they did that to themselves. Al Sharpton, you have a generation now among the younger ones that grew up in a more diverse circumstance in terms of their schools, in terms of who they knew socially. And you've got to remember, and I don't think this is any small part of this, they grew up used to a black president. To them, race was different than their parents or grandparents. In my heart of hearts, I believe this is the trigger that is going to lead to federal legislation. It may take a minute, but I really believe this is different this time because I think that in some of the cases, we've moved black America. This is a case that moves America, all America. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico.